this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
I'm trying to actually make a broader point about sort of Canadian ideological power in the world. And of course, B'nai B'rith doesn't care about any of this, right? B'nai B'rith is just trying to get some sort of gotcha against someone who has stood up to the Israel lobby in Canada.
In February, Canadian author and activist Eve Engler was arrested for his social media posts about Gaza genocide. Now, B'nai B'rith is accusing him of denying the genocide in Rwanda.
They keep moving this unhoused people from basically one location to another. They're not going away. And, you know, doing this to them is not taking care of them.
As Donald Trump signs an executive order criminalizing homelessness, Sacramento, California moves to ban its unhoused population from sleeping overnight outside of City Hall.
When Trump decided to carry out this trade war against Brazil, Lula, the ratings went up.
Trump's 50% tariff on 40% of Brazil's exports to the United States has sparked rising anger and anti-imperialist backlash across Brazil. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Eve Engler is a Canadian activist and the author of many books about Canadian foreign policy, including Canada and Africa, 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation. In February, he was arrested for social media posts about Gaza genocide, and in July, he announced his candidacy to lead the New Democratic Party. Now, B'nai B'rith is accusing him of denying the genocide in Rwanda. He spoke to Pacifica's Ann Garrison.
Eve Engler, what is B'nai B'rith, and why do you think they have suddenly attacked you over something you wrote 8 years ago about the Rwandan genocide?
B'nai B'rith is the second most important Jewish Zionist organization in Canada. It's been around for at least 100 years, and it's a ardent defender of Israel's genocide. It has long smears against Palestinian supporters. And they have attacked me for something I wrote 8 years ago because I have announced that I was going to seek the leadership of the NDP, which is the major social democratic party in Canada that has been government provincially, but has never been government federally, but has been the official opposition federally. And there was a fair bit of buzz and attention given to my announcing that I was going to run for the NDP leadership. And I think that what's happened is that B'nai B'rith has realized that among likely NDP members or supporters claiming that someone is anti-Semitic because they oppose Canada's complicity in Israel's genocide, that doesn't have the same kind of weight that it may have had even 6 months, a year, or 2 years ago. And so they chose to criticize me for something else rather than smearing me as anti-Jewish. And they scoured through my writings on many, many different topics, from cars to Ukraine, different domestic issues to Rwanda. And they came up with an article from 2017 that they feel can frame me as being, in their words, a Rwanda genocide denier, which, of course, is completely erroneous and, quite frankly, libelous. But it is fair to say that I don't agree with the highly simplistic narrative that Paul Kagame has used to justify killing millions of people in the Congo. And I should say that the article in the 2017 article that they're referring to, an important part of what the article is about is how Canadians have assisted Kagame in crafting a very simplistic, self-serving narrative for his dictatorship and violence in the Congo.
So they've chosen the Rwandan genocide to call you a genocide denier because calling you a Gaza genocide denier would somehow not be as effective now?
Yeah, or specifically calling me an anti-Semite for opposing the Israel lobby or for opposing Canada's support for Israel. That's kind of like lost. They've accused everyone of being an anti-Semite over the past 21 months. And so it still holds weight, I think, in the corporate media, but it doesn't hold weight among potential NDP voters, or holds much less weight among potential NDP voters. So they basically went to an issue that people don't know much about, which is Rwanda. And I think that people know that something very bad happened in 1994, mm-hmm. and that's about all they can tell you. And so if you can put in people's heads that this NDP candidate denies this really bad thing that happened, that of course would undermine my credibility. They fit it along with some broader claim that I'm, unhinged or you're not based in facts or some variation of that. And so that's what they've done. And I should say, before B'nai B'rith did this, this public statement, there was an effort by Israel bots. I can't prove this 100%, but there was a sudden, this article from 2017 reappeared in social media. And then I responded to the first person who brought it up, thinking it was actually good faith. And then suddenly dozens, probably hundreds of Israel bot accounts started calling on X to have a community note based upon my wasn't exactly clear if it was based upon my tweet, which didn't have anything of real substance in it, or if it was based upon the article. And they succeeded in getting a community note, which creates the impression that there was some like error in what I had written, which is absolutely not true, based upon the community note that they got. But it created a certain that type of impression. And then B'nai B'rith, 5 or 6 days later, followed that up with this public statement, which they got a couple of Rwandan organizations to put their name to.
Okay, tell us about the press release that they put out attacking you of being a genocide denier.
Yeah, well, they put out a statement on X and then linked to a larger statement, which said that I was a genocide denier or minimizer, and that these types of ideas didn't have any role in official politics. And it was B'nai B'rith that clearly from the statement instigated the statement. And then they got a couple of Rwandan organizations to endorse the statement. So it basically said I was a Rwanda genocide denier. It was based upon this 2017 article where I quoted a number of Canadian media outlets saying that in one case, 800,000 Tutsi were killed in 1994. Another case, 1 million Tutsi were killed in 1994. And I used the documentary, the BBC documentary, The Rwanda Untold Story, and the academics quoted in their staff, where they make the point that the higher the death toll cited for the Rwanda genocide, the higher proportion of Hutu that had to have been killed, because the census in 1991 said there was slightly less than 600,000 Tutsi in Rwanda. There's some debates about those numbers being correct. Some say it's 500,000. I've seen some people say maybe it's as high as towards 1 million. But everyone agrees that there was, at least 300,000 Tutsis that, didn't perish in 1994 in Rwanda. And some say maybe a bit higher than that. So it's literally statistically impossible for 1 million Tutsis to have been killed in 1994. In fact, it would be almost certainly statistically impossible for 800,000 Tutsis to have been killed in 1994. So I start the article off by just pointing out this fairly obvious statistical incongruence, and point out that this inflation is tied to Kagame's propaganda to justify his dictatorship, but also to justify his violence in Congo. But most of what the article is actually about is not neither of those things. It's about Canadians' role in shaping this simplistic narrative of what happened in Rwanda in 1994. That Kagame uses for his criminal violence in Congo. And the most obvious character in that, of course, is Romeo Dallaire, who is the general in charge of the military component of the mission in Rwanda from late 93 to 94. And Romeo Dallaire, even though immediately after the genocidal violence in 94, he described it as much more complicated, what happened in Rwanda, the sort of descent into mass genocidal killing. That was his immediate description of affairs. But as time has gone on, he has very much been a leading advocate, and I would say even shaper, of the official story that Kagame uses for his political purposes. And so the story is mostly about Dallaire and then a couple of other Canadian figures, Gerald Kaplan, who actually wrote the African Union's report in 2000 about mm-hmm. the Rwanda genocide. And Kaplan actually talks about writing the report in Toronto, right? So this is an African Union report funded by the Americans, Canadians assisted, and it's literally written in Toronto, but it's framed as like a, you know, an African report. And so I go into the kind of important role that Canada's played on this. And it actually has some somewhat broader implications for Canadians, because basically what the point I'm trying to make is that Canada's a G7 country. It has powerful ideological capacities. It's mm-hmm. the two main colonial languages, English and French. So mm-hmm. Canadians actually kind of like well-placed to shape international narratives, not just about Rwanda, particularly about Rwanda, but not just about Rwanda. So I'm trying to actually make a broader point about sort of Canadian ideological power in the world. And of course, B'nai B'rith doesn't care about any of this, right? B'nai B'rith is just trying to get some sort of gotcha against someone who has stood up to the Israel lobby in Canada, who has opposed Canada's complicity in Israel's crimes. And so they latched on to this Rwanda article for those purposes.
Okay, so just to highlight what they're using to say gotcha, there were, on the high end, 600,000 Tutsi in Rwanda at the time of the genocide. 300,000 survived, or at least that's the claim by the Ibuka Survivors Group. If there were 600,000 and 300,000 survived, the death toll among the Tutsi could only be 300,000. You know, these numbers are estimates, but the census in 1994 was far below the 800,000 and million killed, and then 300,000 survived. So those are the statistics that they're trying to nail you for reporting.
It's right? Completely, I mean, basically, you what they're saying is you cannot question state accounts. And if you question, right. you look at just literally the statistics that are being offered. I'm not an expert on Rwandan statistics. I'm literally just using Rwandan government census from 1991. I'm also using U.S. academics quoted by the BBC to deal with the statistics. Right. And then Canadian media accounts at that time, in the few weeks before this article was published in 2017, them uh-huh. citing statistics that are literally an impossibility by anyone who looks at the, you know, Rwanda census and, you know, how many survived, how many Tutsi survived after 94, et cetera. But the other part I should also say that is in the article that has now like been actually confirmed post me publishing it. I mean, it was already clear to anyone who took this issue seriously before 2017, but has been absolutely confirmed on the front page of Canada's most important newspaper, the Globe and Mail, is that Kagame is the one who shot down the plane that unleashes the genocidal violence.
Right.
And that basically what the Globe and Mail confirmed in 2018, which I've also wrote about when it, you know, Globe and Mail published this in 2018, that the air-to rocket launchers, it's not the exact term, but the missiles that are fired to shoot down Habyarimana's plane, they trace them to the serial number, they trace them to Ugandan stocks of those missiles. So basically the Ugandans, as not a big surprise to anyone who followed this, gave those to the RPF, who they were supporting in this war that began in 1990. They used those weapons to blow up the plane, and that took the powder keg that was the country, and things went completely haywire, and hundreds of thousands of people killed, and hundreds of thousands of Tutsi were slaughtered because they were Tutsi. But there were also, you know, tens, probably hundreds of thousands of Hutus that were slaughtered as well. And so this is, you can make a good case that an important part of what's in my article is just really kind of far-sighted in terms of, you know, talking about something that has subsequently been on the front page of the Globe and Mail as, oh, huge revelations. The official account has been put into some question because, well, now it was Kagame that shot the plane down, and that, you know, changed the whole context of what happened in those 100 days of mass killing. But that's just ignored by B'nai B'rith and others. And I shouldn't say, but, you know, the Toronto Sun, the right-wing media outlet, they did a story, just a hit piece based upon mm-hmm. B'nai B'rith's account. And they called me, they essentially called me a genocide denier and you know, did exactly what B'nai B'rith wanted.
Okay. Rwanda and its supporters would accuse you and me of genocide denial just for referring to the Rwandan genocide instead of the genocide against the Tutsi, which is the legally codified and enforced description in Rwanda. They haven't passed a law like this that I know of outside Rwanda, but they did mount a successful campaign to get the UN General Assembly to change the name of the International Day of Reflection on the 1994 genocide in Rwanda to the International Day of Reflection on the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda. Has there been a naming campaign like this undertaken in Canada?
I don't believe so.
Okay, French-Cameroonian author Charles Onana has been convicted in France of, quote, denying crimes against humanity with regard to his writing about the Rwanda genocide and specifically about Operation Turquoise and based on French genocide denial laws. They've just expanded this to include not only the Holocaust, but any genocide recognized by an international court, which gives extraordinary power to the international court system. Are there any such laws in Canada banning denial of a genocide recognized by an international court? And do you fear the Zionist and Rwandan Tutsi, if there is, would legally pursue you about this?
There is no similar legislation in Canada that I'm aware of. And I don't think B'nai B'rith would attempt that because I don't think they would have any legal success. And I think that would be just ending up kind of hyping the issue in a way that wouldn't serve their political interests.
Could you talk about Romeo Dallaire, General Romeo Dallaire, and the role that he has played in Canadian perception of the Rwanda genocide?
Yeah. About 5 months ago, I saw that Romeo Dallaire was speaking at the Salon du Livre here in Montreal. Mm-hmm. And so I went there to ask him. I was debating what to ask him about, whether to ask him about Kagame's role mm-hmm. in Congo or to ask him about whether he thought it was a genocide in Gaza. And I was waiting to ask him this question. The person in front of me asked him a question about the M23 role in Congo and whether that had changed his assessment of all the killing that M23 and Rwanda had done in the Congo, whether that changed his assessment of Kagame. And so I ended up asking about Gaza, but I got both of these on, I recorded both my question and the person before me's question, who I actually didn't know. I didn't know who this person was at all. This was just completely unrelated. And Dallaire's response was pretty remarkable. I quoted it. I don't have all the words in front of me, but I wrote a story about this 4 or 5 months ago. And Dallaire effectively said, Rwanda is totally justified to go in the Congo because the genocide are in the Congo, and you got to hit them where they are, and you can't set back, and this totally aggressive Kagame-ist propaganda. I should say a position that's no longer the position of the Globe and Mail, of the Toronto Star, or even the New York Times. This used to be how they justified Rwanda's role in the Congo, but I would say that's become less and less sort of an acceptable framing. So Dallaire, this is just one example, but Dallaire has made the argument for Kagame's violence in the Congo, which has left literally millions of people dead over the past 30 years, which we know led, there was conquering Kinshasa in 96, a reinvasion, a multi-country war, and then just constant destabilization of Eastern Congo that Rwanda has done over the past 30 years. The idea that Dallaire would still be making that argument, and I should say that the Dallaire Institute is based in Kigali. The Canadian government funds the Dallaire Institute. They've been training Rwandan forces, supposedly all about ending child soldiers. Well, there's child soldiers being used by the M23 in Eastern Congo, by Rwanda in Congo. And while the Canadian government's funding this whole project to work with the Rwandan military. So Dallaire has been an important player in enabling at an ideological level Kagame's crimes. But he has concrete relationship with the Rwandan military. He meets with Rwandan military officials, obviously meets with Kagame, and the Canadian government is funding his institute based in Kigali that works with the Rwandan military. So Dallaire is, you know, in Canada, he's this great hero. He is this probably one of the more famous Canadians outside of like the official, you know, politicians, and maybe outside of sports athletes. And he's considered this great humanitarian. But the history books will, I think, very clearly understand Romeo Dallaire as having enabled some of the most horrific crimes in Africa of the, you know, of the past 30 plus years. And I should also note, I did a book on called A Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation back in 2016. And I looked at the dominant media's bias in favor of power. It's all about different ideological institutions in Canada and their foreign policy coverage. The single most impressive propaganda instance in Canadian foreign policy that I'm familiar with it is the coverage of Romeo Dallaire's book versus Jacques Rojabubu, who was the head of the UN mission in Rwanda in 94. So Dallaire was in charge of the military side, but the former Cameroonian foreign minister, Bubu, who was far, far, far more knowledgeable about Rwandan affairs than Romeo Dallaire was. Romeo Dallaire said he didn't even know where Rwanda was on the map before going off on the mission. And Bubu's book, he has a book called Le Patron de Dallaire Parle, so the boss of Dallaire speaks, about Dallaire's support for the RPF in 93-94, among other issues. And that book is basically entirely ignored by the Canadian media. Conversely, Romeo Dallaire's book, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's like thousands and thousands of times it comes up in a Canadian newsstand search of the, you know, major Canadian newspapers. So they just completely ignore the fact that a foreign minister, former foreign minister of an African country who was in charge of the overarching UN mission in Rwanda has detailed how Dallaire took sides contrary to UN principles, and it's just completely ignored while Dallaire's book is taught gone, you know, they go on about it endlessly, and Dallaire is celebrated. And that's also part of what was been in my writing, that this is not just writing from 2017. I have a whole book called Canada and Africa, 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation, where I go into not just Canada's role in Rwanda or Congo, but, you know, across the continent, going back pre-Confederation, going back to the transatlantic slave trade, etc.
Yeah, regarding Dallaire, he is so heroized in both American accounts and Canadian accounts, film accounts, these including Samantha Power's seminal piece, Bystanders to Genocide. Somehow, Dallaire's heroism and his suffering is highlighted. It's at the forefront with the death and the suffering of millions of Rwandan people in the background. It's about this heroic white general who wasn't able to stop it and how much he suffered psychically as a consequence. I just recently saw another movie with that narrative line.
There's almost a bit of an analogy with those in Canada who support Israel's crimes in Gaza, framing themselves as the victims in this whole affair. There's almost a bit of an analogy with the mayor being framed as sort of like a central victim amidst the devastation of tens of millions of people.
Okay, Eve Engler, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio, and good luck with your campaign to lead the New Democratic Party, the NDP, in Canada.
That was Canadian activist and author Eve Engler speaking to Pacifica's Anne Garrison.
حبيت القمر طلع القمر اصطناعي شميت الورد طلع الورد بلاستيكي انا حبيت القمر طلع القمر اصطناعي شميت الورد طلع الورد بلاستيكي تكاتيكي تكاتيكي
That was 47 Soul Gamar. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasiliev. Next, we have a report on homelessness in Sacramento, California, from Fatima Garcia, Pacifica Radio contributor and independent journalist with El Pueblo Platica.
Today, we're talking about something that hits at the heart of life, community and justice, homelessness. Sacramento, like many cities across the country, is facing a housing crisis. In response, the city council recently passed a controversial ordinance banning unhoused neighbors from sleeping overnight at City Hall, a move that many see as criminalizing poverty rather than addressing its root causes. Meanwhile, on the federal level, President Trump has issued a new executive order targeting encampments and calling for stricter federal interventions on homelessness, steering fear of increased sweeps and fewer protections for our most vulnerable neighbors. Today, we're joined by Armando Cielo Flores from CAFE, a grassroots organization doing critical work on the ground here in Sacramento to fight for housing justice and dignity for all. Welcome, Armando.
My name is Armando Flores, and I'm the president and founder of CAFE. And our group is targeting mainly taking care of the people that are living on the streets by providing food, clothing, and most of the essential needs that they have. We do this every Sunday or at Chavez Park. And at the moment, we are at a point where we are providing services for 150 to almost 200 people every Sunday. The goal of our group is to maintain people fed and clothed so that they can survive living on the streets and dealing with the issues that they have to live by being out in house, you know, such as making sure that they're covered, making sure that they're not hungry, making sure that they have something to drink, and also providing with resources that they can have to help them if they need any kind of help.
That's amazing work, Armando. And I know that you've been doing this like independent funding. And I think it's so important for us to uplift the organizations that are doing this work and have been doing this work for a long time. Can you tell us about how you collect the donations? How do you make sure that you're out there every Sunday with community?
Well, the main source of our food and clothing is donations by friends, family, and the public that is aware of who we are and what we do. So people donate to our group. We also have a group of volunteers who provide the food. They provide the drinks and other essentials that we need to have to provide to the homeless, which is a lot of toiletries, blankets, towels, jackets, you know, shoes, socks. We try to make sure that we, like I said, provide enough for them so that they can survive living on the streets. Our feeding is only once a week, you know, which is very limited, but we do it on a day that most places that provide for the unhoused are closed or they just don't serve that day.
And how long have you been doing this? Because it's been consistent every Sunday, right?
Yes. CAFE has been doing our service for 15 years now.
That's amazing. 15 years of community coming together and grassroots level. The reason why I think this model is so important is because the increased number of people who will be in house is going to grow drastically with all of these executive orders from the federal administration. So, you know, we can do it. We can come together as community and take care of each other. And CAFE here in Sacramento has been a great example of that. So thank you, Armando, to you and all the volunteers that make this effort possible. The Sacramento new ordinance bans unhoused individuals from sleeping at City Hall, a place that's become symbolic for protest and visibility. What's your take on this policy and what do you think it says about the city's priorities?
Well, I just think it's very cruel, unfair, and it's kind of in a way a criminal move they have made, because that's a safe people feel that they can use at night protected to be covered by, you know, an overhead that is at the building, but also being in a public place where they can be seen. They're not in the dark, and there's not too many people running around in the area that can hurt them or whatever. So that's something that is going to be more dangerous than anything to do. Particularly, they were just sleeping there, but they were leaving the area every morning at 6 o'clock. So, you know, it's plenty of time for the city to clean up the area and organize what they have to do and open their doors to the public. You know, and basically the period of time that they were allowed to be there, there really wasn't any problems with them there as far as any criminal activities or things like that. So it's really unfair that for no reason they just decided that they don't want him there anymore. And also that's going to cause more problems for our city, because that's sending all those people to different communities that for some reason do not want him there, or do not, you know, or feel that they're not safe by the unhoused being in their area. So I think a lot of people in the community are going to be upset by this move, as well as, you know, the unhoused.
Thank you for that. Thank you. I do agree that this is not a solution. It's a temporary band-aid that can cause a lot more issues for our city. So in the last 15 years, you've done a lot of direct outreach, mutual aid, and public advocacy. Can you share a recent moment that really highlights the current unhoused crisis in Sacramento? Can you share how your analysis on being on the ground 15 years ago to now, something that really is highlighted for you?
One of the things that I see now, and I'm glad that we have, is more communicative and more able to share what they're doing and share how they're feeling because of our social media. So I'm glad that there's a lot of people that are seeing exactly what, you know, the unhoused people go through, the unhoused people live, and also trying to understand and learn more about the issue rather than just thinking, oh, we have a problem and nobody's fixing it. I think more people are getting, ideas and getting educated to the point where they want a solution and they want to find a way that they can solve and help clean the or fix the issue, because it's not just a city, you know, or government house, a community issue that we have to take into consideration that, you know, these are people that are from our community. Some of them, they're people that we know, they're people that we, you know, maybe did business with, they're people that, you know, somehow we passed with before. And, you know, they're not criminals, they're not people that just want to live out in the street. They're, you know, most of them are people that, you know, really need help, and they're put in a situation not by their choice.
Yeah, I think that we've become desensitized as a community to our unhoused neighbors. And the reality is that we're all a paycheck, a crisis, an emergency away from being in a similar situation. Thank you for bringing humanity and humility and empathy into the conversation, Armando. Trump's new executive order aims to increase federal involvement in dismantling homeless encampments. In other words, more sweeps. How might this impact local organizing efforts, and what concerns do you have about how it could play out on the ground?
Well, I think that, you know, this order, you know, again, it's something criminal. It's something that should not be happening. I think rather than, you know, sweeping these people and trying to take their possessions away, and is making it more of a problem, because literally you're having people that are, you know, being able to have a tent, able to have a sleeping bag, bedding, you know, blankets, things like that. And when a sweeping comes, they don't really give them time to take what they need or take their belongings with them. So they lose everything. And that's a problem for groups like my cafe and other organized groups that are in the city, because we have to provide those items to these people again so that they can continue to survive, so they can be protected. So, you know, I don't see any benefit of these sweeps. I think if the city was more creative, they could create a way of, you know, fixing the problem, you know, maintaining the area where the people are living cleaner for them, you know, because they let it get to a point where it looks unsafe and unhealthy. Is because, you know, city is not providing any way of garbage collection, water supplies, things that they need. So you have a really hard time getting from one place to another. So it's really hard for them to go find a place where they can clean themselves, where they can use the restroom, you know, even where they can drink water. So I think the sweeps are just creating more issues because they keep moving this and house people from basically one location to another. They're not going away. And, you know, doing this to them is not taking care of them.
Yeah, that's right on, Armando. We know that policy change is just one part of the equation. What kinds of community responses, things everyday people can do, do you found to be most meaningful or effective in supporting unhoused neighbors?
Well, like I said, you know, I think our community needs, educating, number one. I think a lot of people are misled about what being unhoused is and the reasons why people are unhoused. You know, most people just assume, you know, they're drug addicts, they're criminals, they're people that don't, you know, lazy people that don't want to work. They're not taking into consideration that one of the main problems that a lot of the unhoused have is mental health issues. So I think a lot of them get to a point where they lose control of their issues. Their mental issues become worse because they're not able to have a, you know, mental health doctor take care of them. They don't have access to medications. They don't have transportation to, you know, reach the doctor and reach places where they can pick up medication. So, you know, I think their problems get worse with time. Also, you know, we have a lot of people that are out there that have been abused and are running away from violent situations in their families and communities. So people need to understand that, you know, I don't really think there's any unhoused person that, you know, had a nice way of living. And all of a sudden they decided, oh, I'm just going to be unhoused today. And I'm going to give up what I have and go live in the streets. I don't think that's a choice that, you know, a lot of these people make. It's just something that happens to them. And like I said, there's a lot of different situations why they're out there, you know. And right now, the most problem that I keep seeing with new people coming into the streets is the economic issues that we are having in, you know, in our country. You know, things are getting more expensive. Jobs are, you know, getting hard to find. So there's really no quick solution to the problem. And besides that, you know, our housing is very minimal. We need to be looked at and figure out how we can put them in safer places for themselves and also for the community. Because I think a lot of people feel threatened by people being, you know, on the streets, walking around. And you know, the first thing people assume is like, they're coming to do something to me. They're going to kill me or they're going to rob me. And they don't realize that these people are just living out there. You know, they're just going on with their lives, trying to make the best that they can. And, you know, they're really not a threat. I haven't, in the 15 years that I've been helping people that are in house, I have never been attacked or, you know, abused by any of them. So, you know, something that is really minimal that could happen. If we just rely on having the government fix it, it would be impossible because there's so much work that needs to be done, not just, you know, by the government, but also, like I say, by the community. We need to be more accepting. We need to be more humane to at least try to understand why people have these issues and not judge them. And not categorize them, criminalize them because of their situation, which is what has been happening by the government and also by a lot of people, because sometimes there's people that are violent who will come into the street and hurt the unhoused just because they're there. You know, and that's another problem that we have with our society too. Like, it's not just the unhoused that have mental issues. It's a lot of people in our communities have those problems. It's just not as visible because they're mostly contained at home or people cover the map. You know, they're able to go to work and pretend they're somebody and then there's somebody else, you know, outside of work or outside their regular life. So I think tolerance and acceptance, compassion, love.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Armando, for the work you've been doing with your volunteers and community at large. As always, it's the voices closest to the struggle that hold the clearest vision for justice. Muchas gracias.
Gracias a ti, Fatima.
That was Armando Flores of CAFE, clothing and food for all. Speaking to Fatima Garcia, Pacifica Radio contributor and independent journalist with El Pueblo Platica from Sacramento, California.
Voy a crear un canto para poder existir, para mover la tierra, los hombres y sobrevivir, para curar mi corazón, a la mente dejarla fluir, para el espíritu elevar y dejarlo llegar al fin. Yo no nací sin causa, yo no nací. A la felicidad voy a crear un canto para el cielo respetar, para mover las raíces de este campo y hacerlo brotar, para mover las aguas, el veneno verde que hay por ahí, para el espíritu elevar y dejarlo vivir en paz. Yo no nací. Y así perseguir a la felicidad, que es un derecho de nacimiento, es el motor de nuestro movimiento, porque reclamo libertad de pensamiento, si no la pido es porque estoy muriendo. Es un derecho de nacimiento, mira los frutos que dejan los sueños, en una sola voz y un sentimiento, y que este grito limpie nuestro viento.
Natalia Lafourcade singing Derecho de Nacimiento. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Donald Trump's 50% tariff on 40% of Brazil's exports to the United States has sparked rising anger and anti-imperialist backlash across Brazil. Last Friday, unions nationwide rallied outside U.S. embassies in protest. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with Fabio Bosco, a Brazilian transit worker and member of the independent labor federation Com Lutas, about the working class resistance to Trump's trade war, as well as the U.S. president's demand that charges be dropped against Brazilian far-right ex-president Jair Bolsonaro for his role in the 2022 coup attempt.
General feeling among the Brazilians is that Trump administration decided to impose these 50% tariffs, not only because of Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro is on the verge of going to jail, you see? But not only because of him, but there are also the interests of the big techs that are against the regulations that are under discussion here in Brazil that might pose some taxes on them. And there is also another issue, which is free transfer of money. Here in Brazil, we have something that is coordinated by the central bank that allow all Brazilians to transfer money without paying any kind of tax, you see? So the most visible reason for Trump administration to carrying out this trade war against Brazil has to do with Bolsonaro, but there are other hidden agenda behind this backlash. And what happened? I can tell you that it backfired, Steve, because Trump targeted Brazil, but he shot Bolsonaro. What was happening just before this announcement by Trump administration? The Lula administration here in Brazil was on the low. And when Trump decided to carry out this trade war against Brazil, Lula, the ratings went up. Lula is becoming popular. And now this decision of Trump to resort to a U.S. law called Magnitsky Law and to target one member of the Brazilian Supreme Court who is in charge of the trial of Bolsonaro and all the coup plotters made this man, this judge, a popular personality here in Brazil, you see? So it's curious how all these actions by Trump administration brings a feeling of anti-imperialist perspective among the working class and the people in general.
Well, the people that supported Bolsonaro, and he had support in the United States for his attempted coup, that coup took place, I mean, the insurrection took place in the United States, was unsuccessful. What does that mean politically in Brazil, the growth of fascist and right-wing forces in relationship to what Trump is now doing?
Steve, this phenomenon of the far right becoming more popular here in Brazil, we have been dealing with this for maybe 10 years. The far right is on the rise. And Bolsonaro administration, when he was elected, managed to put together things that were different. There are people that they would like to have a military dictatorship in Brazil. So they are together with religious conservative people. They are together with mafias. They are together with agribusiness. He put together different social groups in order to make this, let's say, this rise of the far right. And the election of Trump in the US, of course, make this movement stronger. In this case of the trade war, it backfired. So at this moment, the Bolsonaro group, they are in the defensive, trying to explain why they are doing that. And so they are in a difficult position at this moment. But before this trade war that Trump started, they were moving upwards.
And Lula and his government have said that the development of BRICS is an alternative to IMF, United States, and the U.S. Control of the world economy, WTO. What is that perspective, and what is the reality of that?
I think that the BRICS will not be this alternative itself. What's happening is that China capitalism is on the rise, and they are disputing in terms of trade economics with the U.S. In across the world. And China is taking advantage of BRICS to try to put around them an alternative to the U.S. hegemony. But the BRICS is a very contradictory block of countries. You see, you have countries that are closer to the U.S., you have countries that are closer to China. Here, the government talks a lot about BRICS becoming this alternative in some way. But I feel that in reality, what Brazilian administration is trying to do is to try to get advantage from this dispute between the U.S. and China to make better bargaining for the Brazilian exports and this kind of stuff, you see? That's my feeling.
But what is the situation of the working class in Brazil, and what is the effect of Chinese investments in Brazil in relationship to the working class and the unions?
When Trump started this tariff stuff, it's something curious happened among the working class, because the working class suddenly started to see the Chinese capitalists as something more friendly to them and to Brazil than the U.S. one. Suddenly, China becomes something popular as well. In this moment, China is, let's say, something sympathetic to Brazil, and this is helped a lot by the fact that the majority of the left-wing groups in Brazil, they love China. I think they think China is the new leadership for the socialists across the world, despite of the fact it's a totally capitalist country. So I think that this is the feeling, the average feeling among the Brazilian working class regarding China at this moment.
And the global movement against the genocide in Gaza, there's a movement obviously in Brazil to support the Palestinians against the genocide. What is happening with that movement? And also, what is the relationship of Lula to Israel? Are they breaking off relations? Are they stopping all trade with Israel?
Lula administration, since day one of the genocide, they do something like this. They criticize the genocide and they criticize the Palestinian resistance. You see, they have one foot in each boat, let's say. But Lula made strong denouncing against the genocide. but the decisions are modest. They exist, but they are modest. Facing what Brazil is doing, for instance, Steve, Brazil is exporting oil to Israel. Today, Brazil is the fourth largest exporter of oil to Israel. So the labor unions are doing a beautiful work. They are putting pressure on the government to stop it, but the government did not stop. The trade relations and the diplomatic relations are kept, but there are some symbolic actions by the government that makes Lula maybe one of the most popular presidents among the Palestinians, you see? The Palestinians look to Lula as someone that's on their side, but I can tell you that what Lula do is try to have a strong condemnation of the genocide, a wording that is strong, but the actions do not follow the same level. So he took two decisions these days. One was to endorse, fully endorse, the South Africa initiative in the International Court of Justice to condemn Israel for genocide. So that's something positive, late but positive. And the other one is there is an association that's called IHRO, which they decided on a definition for anti-Semitism that puts anyone who raises any criticism against Israel as anti-Semitic. So Lula, Brazil endorsed that before, but now last week, Brazil decided to withdraw from this organization as a full member. Now they are an observer and they are criticizing this definition. So that's good. That's good because many of us, I myself included, are being attacked as for this definition just because we are criticizing and fighting against the genocide that's going on in Palestine. Brazil is not one of the centers of the solidarity to Palestine. It's not nothing like the Europe or the US, but still there is an active movement here in all capitals, and they are managed to put pressure on the government. We had the largest demonstration ever had in Brazil for Palestine with 30,000 people in São Paulo 1 month ago. And some important singers, they joined a manifesto asking Lula to break the diplomatic and economic relations with Israel. So I can tell you the solidarity movement here in Brazil is on the rise, is in its best moment, when the Palestinians are in this, that is one of the worst situations that any people is under across the world. At this moment, the popularity of Trump is very low because they see him as a kind of imperialist dictator that do whatever he wants. He does not care with the other countries or the poor or the immigrants. The issue of immigrants is also a big issue here in Brazil. Because look, there are many Brazilians that they don't have papers and they are in the US. And so the Brazilians feel that it's not fair what's happening there. This very aggressive and shameful way of deporting people. Maybe if they did in a hidden way, kind of Obama did, you see. Obama was deporting thousands of immigrants, right? But
he called the chief deporter. Subtle.
Isn't it? Yeah.
He called the chief deporter.
But Trump do a lot of noise. And so the Brazilians do not feel represented by these kind of actions against the immigrants, definitely. So the popularity of Trump at this moment in Brazil is very low.
That was Fabio Bosco, Brazilian transit worker and member of the Independent Labor Federation, Con Lutas, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Anne Garrison, Steve Zeltzer, Fatima Garcia, and myself, Polina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.